right here is for the people.
Good afternoon, people. It's Fran and I behind the Renaissance Wheel today for Podcast 26. The more that I dive into mindfulness, the recurring problem I run into is just being able to explain it to someone else. Although the words may come out correctly, I describe it well, the meaning is rarely translated. It also becomes clearer that we have very little control over our thoughts and our decisions, and this is quite contrary to what we believe. The fact that mindfulness requires practice and discipline, I actually think is quite good, because it's something so special that it should be earned and it should be deserved. Now, our guest on the podcast today is one of the leading figures in taking this complex subject and explaining it in his best-selling book called Mindfulness, Finding Peace in a Frantic World, and having great success at converting the readers to becoming mindful. So, Fran and I are mega excited to have Mr. Danny Penman joining us today. Welcome, Danny.
Hi, how are you?
Very good.
Good, looking forward to this.
I actually had a little look through, I thought, let me just see if there's anything on YouTube, and I went through, and one of the first videos when I tapped your name in was actually the BBC breakfast video.
Oh, yes, of course, yes.
So I thought, let me watch this, and you didn't turn up until the second part of it.
Yeah.
But the few moments that you were there, you've done a really great job in just explaining everything about mindfulness. And, you know, I guess it's good as well, because obviously you had the nice little clip beforehand showing the MRI scans of the brain.
Yeah.
And it makes a difference, you know, on the ego or whatever it is, whatever section of the brain that actually calms down. So, yeah, really, really good. So I'm looking forward to this.
Yeah. I mean, the one thing that came out in that program, which I think was very, very important, was just how much science is involved in mindfulness. Because, you know, if we just kind of focused on subjective things about, you know, how nice it makes you feel and how calm you become, well, that's great. And, you know, both of those things are true. But it's really great to see somebody's brain in a brain scanner calming down and actually becoming more kind of balanced. And I just think it's really important to have that kind of objective evidence.
Seeing the visuals as well with the MRI scan and seeing the actual effects it has. You know, I was actually quite blown away with that, because although I'd experienced it or thought I felt like that, but seeing the results on a, as you said, being able to see the brain now, it's just quite amazing.
Yes.
And that is actually one of the videos that I sent to my friends in as part of a package, if you like, when trying to get them into mindfulness. Yeah. The thing that I really liked about it is that David Sillitoe?
Oh, that's right. Yeah, David Sillitoe. Yes.
David Sillitoe. And, you know, the way he speaks and the way he presents himself, he looks like a very, you know, conservative, formal journalist, and given this assignment to go and find out a bit more about mindfulness. And I just love that at the end he was, you know, well, it's something I'm still doing today. You know, I'm still doing my daily meditations, and, you know, whenever I'm the daily strifes get a little bit angry, that, you know, he has these tools that he can use. And
yeah,
I love the way that he says, I don't really know what's going on, or, but, you know, it is doing something.
exactly. But it's, I mean, it is such a powerful technique, and yet it's, you know, it is so, so simple. That's what I love about it, because, you know, at the end of the day, mindfulness is quite simply paying full conscious attention to whatever is going on around you. And that could be anything at all, you know. It could be focusing on the kind of smells or sounds that surround you on a tube train. But, you know, traditionally it's been cultivated by focusing on the sensations the breath makes as the air flows into and out of the body. And that has two really profound effects. The first one is it's tremendously soothing and relaxing, and you can actually feel your mind and body relaxing when you do a very simple meditation like that. But over time, you also learn that the mind is quite tricky, you know. It keeps on running away with itself, so that one thought leads on to the next and the next and the next. And you learn that actually thoughts just come and go of their own accord. You actually have surprisingly little effect over the you know, the surprisingly little control that the thoughts that come and go into your mind. You know, we all like this idea that we're kind of logical, rational people, but actually thoughts just come and go of their own accord. And this is what you learn through mindfulness, and eventually you realize that the most important thing about being human is actually being fully aware. You know, we associate being human with thoughts, and actually that's just one aspect of us. The most important thing is to have this full conscious awareness. And then you realize that actually, you know, if those thoughts come and go of their own accord, they're not actually giving you a kind of complete and accurate view of the world, you know, because they're so influenced by our emotions. So that if we're unhappy, for example, we tend to conjure up more and more negative thoughts. And, you know, this can lead to depression eventually, you know, and if we're stressed, the mind will conjure up more and more stressful thoughts and anxious thoughts, which again can lead to kind of clinical level anxiety or stress. And once you realize it's actually profoundly liberating, because you're no longer a slave to the thoughts that go through your mind. You can actually start to kind of control the direction of your own life a lot more. And this is why in the clinical studies that have been done, you know, mindfulness has been shown to be at least as good as drugs or counseling for treating depression, for example.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no, definitely. I mean, it kind of takes me back to when I first started getting into meditation. It was around 2008. And it was through looking at NLP, neurolinguistics.
Oh, yes, yes.
So I've actually done the master's course with the Brain People recently.
Yeah.
But yeah, obviously going back to that, I think NLP started off as like a therapy, didn't it? So
yes.
So I mean, they were finding out what all that, because they were saying, why are all these therapists constantly getting their clients, and what's their success rate? And it wasn't very much; it was about 10 or 20%.
Yes.
So yeah, they constantly have customers, but they never get better. So what they did, they actually started looking for models. So that's what NLP is about. It's about modeling behaviors. So they went to find the people that managed to get over these phobias and fears and anxieties and other clinical terms, whatever they're called. Yeah. And they found that, you know, if they use the techniques that the successful people use, they can actually use those and model them and show them to other people.
Yeah.
So that's kind of what got me started on that journey, as well as the, you know, being into martial arts and reading up about Eastern meditation and stuff.
Yeah.
So, I started feeling a bit more. I realized how much more relaxed I was feeling as well, and you know, all the stresses that I used to stress about just kind of melted away sometimes, you know. Until obviously my mind brought them back, and then I thought, oh, no, I better start stressing about them again.
Mm-hmm. Well, it's quite interesting about the idea of getting to mindfulness through martial arts, because. You know, we lock up so much tension and stress in our bodies, so that any physical movement at all, really, will have, you know, a very, very relaxing effect on the body. You know, just exercise is a brilliant way of relieving stress and depression, for example.
It's another form of meditation. I mean, it's when you get into that zone, you know, it's very similar, but a moving meditation almost.
Yes, well, exactly. And, you know, it's like yoga. I mean, yoga has obviously people do say that yoga is a moving meditation. So, yeah, martial arts are an extension of that in many ways.
Yeah, definitely. I do a bit of yoga now and again. So, it's definitely, I do find it very relaxing as well. On days when you don't really feel like going too hard on the exercise, you want to do a bit of yoga, but you end up still pushing yourself because it's still... You know, the fine movements of the muscles, etc. So when you're holding the poses, you know, you're holding positions that you wouldn't normally hold.
Just
sitting at a desk all the time, for instance. Yeah. So I mean, even that's very beneficial. Just doing that for even half an hour, an hour. You know, just squeezing that in at least once a week.
Yeah,
because I think a lot of people don't do too much enough stretching. So I mean, people go to the gym, so they'll probably pump a lot of weights, for instance, but
yeah,
then their muscles will get tight because they don't elongate them and stretch them out again.
Well, that's true. Yes, I got into mindfulness through a a very interesting route, I think. I was paragliding over the Cotswolds.
Paragliding.
Yeah. I used to be really into to paragliding. It was kind of the centre of my life for about 5 years or so. And one day I was over the edge of the hills, and my paragliding canopy collapsed, and I fell about in total about 30 feet, and I kind of battled with this all the way down, and luckily I landed on my feet, but unfortunately the lower half of my right leg was driven through the knee and into my thigh.
I was just about to say, the impact must have been
I mean, it was horrific. I mean, I was, as I said, I was extremely lucky. I managed to land on my feet, but I was in a right state, and the only way I could control the pain whilst I waited for the ambulance to arrive was this form of meditation that I'd learned when I was in sixth form many years previously. And much to my surprise, it allowed me to kind of keep calm on the hillside, and it didn't completely get rid of the pain, but it diminished it an awful lot, and it kind of put a thin sliver of distance between me and the pain, and allowed me to cope essentially until the ambulance arrived. And then over the following month in hospital, I had a couple of very big operations, and it was a pretty horrible time, as you can imagine. And I decided that, you know, I started to use this very simple breathing meditation when I was in hospital. I found it was incredibly effective, you know, relieving the stress and obviously the anxiety and you know, the deep unhappiness I was feeling, because I was in a lot of pain, you know. And I spent my time in the hospital, and then over the following 5 or 6 months of convalescence, learning more and more about this meditation, because initially I didn't even know its name. And I subsequently learned that it was a form of mindfulness meditation. And I tracked down Professor Mark Williams of Oxford University, who had actually turned this meditation into a form of therapy or a treatment for clinical level depression. And I found his work absolutely fascinating, because he produced this 8-week program that NICE, that's the National Institute for Health and Clinical Excellence, they just approved it for use in the NHS, and they reckoned it was at least as good as drugs or counselling for treating depression.
Yeah.
And probably very effective for anxiety and stress too. So I spent a lot of time talking to Mark, and eventually we decided to turn his work into a book, which is the one that you were talking about earlier. That's mindfulness.
It's actually separated out into 8 weeks as well, isn't it?
It is, yes. Essentially, the book is a more consumer-ready version of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy, which is the therapy that Mark co-developed. And it just makes it a lot easier, because the full MBCT course is about 40 or 45 minutes of meditation per day. And ours is about 20. But they're essentially the same meditations. And it's proving to be extremely effective, you know. I mean, it wasn't originally designed to help people with kind of clinical level depression, but it's turning out a lot of people are using it for full-blown depression and gaining relief from it. I mean, it's really designed for people who are just struggling with the kind of relentless demands of the workplace and just the general hassle of life at the moment. And, you know, that's what it's designed for and it's very effective for. But it is also proving to be quite useful for people with depression.
And just to mention that one of your interviews, you say this, but 10% of people per year. I don't know if that was UK specific, but you know, are going to face clinical depression and a handful more just depression in general.
Yeah,
you know, yeah. So it's huge numbers.
It's pretty similar across the developed world. You know, around 10% of the population can expect to become depressed within the next year or so, and in total, about a quarter of the population can expect to become depressed at some point in their life. And you know, this is actually a serious mental health issue, because you know, people think depression is just, you know, feeling unhappy for a prolonged period of time.
Yeah, it's like, come on, get over it.
Yeah, exactly. Exactly. Which of course,
it is actually a biological
isn't it? It is. Well, it's both, really. It's a psychological, there's a feedback between the thoughts in the mind and, you know, a biological or a chemical problem, in that it seems that if you have enough negative thoughts flowing through your mind, you will actually start suppressing the chemistry of your brain, and therefore you will actually lead to a kind of a physical problem. So there's a constant feedback. Yeah, it's a really complex problem, but mindfulness is proving to be one of the most effective treatments for it. And you know, it's just very interesting to come across a treatment that was, if well, it was developed 2,500 years ago. It's so effective for one of the biggest problems in the modern world. You know,
a video that springs to my mind was the YouTube video. It was called "Learn How to Meditate." There were actually 5 parts, and I think it was actually narrated by Deepak Chopra.
Oh yeah, yeah.
And the, I don't know if you've seen it, but the animations to it are quite good as well, because it talks about how the mind has a lot of thoughts coming in and out, and that also constricts the flow of chi, as he calls it, or cosmic energy. I don't know. Would you?
You refer it to as the propaganda of your
that's
memories.
That maybe people start thinking, "Well, this is a meditation. This is what it's all about." Like, you know, it's a bit mystical, hippie, or I don't know.
Yeah. I just think it's a very good analogy to say, you know, it's propaganda. It's the mind doing its best to solve a problem. By constantly thinking about a problem, your mind is doing its absolute level best to solve that problem. But of course, the mind ties itself in knots, you know, and it produces a whole stream of propaganda to kind of reinforce how it's feeling. And that's where depression comes from, really, is that constant stream of negative thoughts. And if you can actually step outside of that stream of negative thoughts and start to relate to it differently, then that is a tremendously liberating force. You know, it's, you know, it's easier said than done. I mean, you do need to spend 10 or 20 minutes a day meditating, but it is very, very effective. And you know, people are, I say that, you know, you need to spend 10 or 20 minutes per day, but actually the lessons you learn from meditation can be carried through to the rest of the day. So, you know, any amount of meditation is effective. It's just within reason, the more you do, the more effective it tends to be.
But it shouldn't really be that difficult when you consider that most people sit down for more than 10 or 20 minutes doing nothing sometimes anyway.
So, well, absolutely. I mean, absolutely.
To, you know, being mindful about.
Yeah. And if you think how much time you spend each day essentially just chasing your own thoughts with no positive end result, well, I mean, if you spent a tenth of that time meditating, you'd end up liberating far more time than the meditation itself takes, you know, because we spend so much time just essentially, well, as I said, chasing our own tails.
That's right. It kind of clears the clutter, doesn't it? The clutter of thoughts. So when you do that, you take a moment to kind of just observe the thoughts and brush them aside and carry on with your breathing. And then sometimes you'll get one thought where you think, that's all I need to do today. That's my meditation done.
Yeah.
And you get up. Sometimes I feel like just 10 minutes in, I'm like, yeah, I don't need to do anymore.
Yeah, well, exactly. You know, just spending 10 minutes a day closing your eyes, focusing on the breath, and when a thought pops into your mind, as it inevitably will, if you just observe it for a moment, it will just dissolve and leave behind a really calm state of mind and return the focus of your awareness back to the sensations of the breath. And, you know, sooner or later, usually sooner, another thought will pop into your mind, and, you know, just observe what that thought is and then return your awareness back to the breath. And that is essentially all you need to know about mindfulness.
So when we hear of the pharmaceutical industry, you know, and the amount of drugs that they make in order to, you know, quote unquote, you know, solve depression.
Yeah.
It's more in the US, as far as I've heard of, you know, cases of, you know, babies at 2 years old being given some form of, you know, antidepressants.
Oh my God.
But there was a picture that someone posted the other day of a sick child going to the doctor with depression. And, you know, the first image is, you know, here, take two of these a day.
Oh no.
And then, you know, come back to me in a month. And the other picture is, you know, do exercise, you know, every day. Do 20 minutes of mindfulness meditation, have a good diet, and come and see me in, you know, in a month.
Yes, yeah.
Do you know what I mean? That basic, you know, why not go with that first?
Yes.
You know, if it's got that proof for it, I think there was an investment of about £500,000 in mindfulness in the NHS. You know, there is, and as you mentioned, that it's starting to be, you know, formally practiced now in the hospitals.
Yes.
But not to the scale, you know, like if it's going to be, you know, a quarter of the population, you know, with one tenth of that being clinically affected.
Yeah.
It definitely has a place. But, you know, if I'm a pharmaceutical company making so much money on these antidepressants, it's not the, you know, I want to try my damn best to, you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, exactly. I mean, there are obviously cases where people... I mean, if somebody is suffering from, you know, a serious depression, it is important that they go and see their doctor. And, you know, sometimes there will be prescribed antidepressants or whatever. But, you know, I would always, on a personal level, choose mindfulness first. But people should go to their doctor if they are worried about their mental state, because, you know, there are effective treatments. I mean, mindfulness is brilliant. But there are other effective treatments as well. And I think that it is important that people go and see their doctor if they're worried about it.
And don't you think that it's not, you know, prevention is the best cure, you know?
Oh, absolutely. It's
almost like this is a life skill, you know. It should be mandatory in schools, because, you know, mindfulness is one part of the puzzle in you know, in thriving, or, you know, living the best life that you can.
Oh, absolutely, yeah.
I guess next month, based in Scotland, he began this organisation, Mindfulness in Schools with Youth. And, you know, children up to 7 years, I mean, from 7 years old, are being, you know, playing these games, these mindfulness games, and they're being introduced, and he's doing it in a wonderful way. Hmm. You know, what are your thoughts on, you know, mindfulness with, you know, the quite young?
Well, I think it's really important, because, as you said, you know, prevention is better than cure. I mean, the reason we wrote our book originally was to actually stop people becoming depressed, you know, to help people before they hit that crunch point. And, you know, it's effective at that. But, I mean, what would be even more effective is teaching kids of whatever age to do some basic meditations. You know, it doesn't have to be a formal meditation each day. I mean, that would be ideal, but it doesn't have to be that. It really is about learning how to live in the real physical world, you know, with full conscious awareness. So it's stuff like paying attention to the food that you're eating. So you taste it in all the different flavors. it's how it smells, the textures, things like that. It's actually living in the material world more completely. That is the key to mindfulness, you know. And so to teach those basic skills in school, I think would be hugely beneficial in the long run to this country's mental health.
What do you think it is that's causing all this depression nowadays?
I think it's there's lots and lots of different causes, I think. I think that one is we live in such a hyper-competitive world that, you know, clearly only 1% or less of the population can sit at the top of the tree. And that means 99% of the population are deemed to be failures. And that erodes people's happiness and well-being like nothing else. Now, of course, it's complete nonsense because everybody, absolutely everybody, can be a success in one field or another. And just really doesn't matter what that field is. You know, people need to be cherished for their own sake. You know, I mean, everybody is unique. And unless as a society we start to accept that, then we're just going to get these continuing problems, you know. You know, we have to accept on an individual level that we might not actually all be able to be the president of the United States or be a financier who earns hundreds of millions of pounds a year in bonuses, you know. And I just think it's obscene that we just can't accept each other's differences and our different abilities and... You know, I do think that that's one of the driving forces behind these problems. Mm-hmm. And I also think the fact that we are constantly bombarded with idealized images of the life we should be leading, you know, yeah, I mean, just, you know, everybody is not going to look like, you know, a supermodel. It's just not going to happen.
A supermodel body, you have to have, I think it's the odds of 1 in 20,000 or 40,000.
Absolutely, absolutely. And yet, you know, that's just one definition of beauty in any case. Mm-hmm. So yeah. I think it's stuff like that that's causing tremendous problems in society. And, you know, I always feel that 95% of the world's problems could be solved if we all became vegetarian or vegan, if we walked or cycled to work, and we worked substantially less hard. And, okay, that's slightly idealistic, but it eradicates most of the problem.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And couple that with 20 minutes of meditation, and you're going to have a happy and fulfilling life.
Hmm. Well, that's supposed to be part of technology, wasn't it? Technology was supposed to be there to give us an easy life.
Yeah, I mean, John Maynard Keynes, who founded modern economics, and he came up with the economic system that basically drove post-war economic growth. He reckoned that we would be only working a few hours per day by the year 2000. You know, literally 2, 3, 4 hours per week. That's all we would need to provide all of our material needs. And it didn't happen, did it? And the reason it didn't happen is because lots of needs have been manufactured. And, you know, it may be that some people do genuinely want to work 40, 50, 60-hour weeks. But I think most people are just driven to it by our over-materialistic culture. Mm-hmm. And, you know, overwork is the biggest killer of mental health and happiness.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, again, this is slightly idealistic because some people are really under the cosh. You know, people are, you know, really suffering financially, especially at the moment. But I do think it's important to start trying to find a way out of that. And I don't feel that... The present system is answering our basic needs.
So is there any progress on that front? Because the way that John Kabat-Zinn described it, it's as a movement. I really like that word, you know. Yeah. And You know, through the different mediums, especially with internet, you know, YouTube, Facebook, Twitter, and the more stories, the more like facts and scientific research that's being done in mindfulness, it's like to be exposed. So it's there now, and there is a street. You know, quite frankly, we are quite late to jump on, but now it's in a internet stage where it can be blasted to, you know, virally.
Yeah.
And, you know, people like Russell Simmons, Ellen DeGeneres,
yeah,
Oprah Winfrey, Russell Brand,
yeah,
you know, they're more, you know, high profile people that are, you know, fighting the fight.
Yeah. Well, this is what it takes, is we do need to fundamentally shift our minds, to want of a better word. And of course, that's going to be a long, slow progress, but a long show project rather, but it is happening, you know. I mean, I am astonished at the speed that things are moving, because when I wrote that book with Mark, it came out, what, 4 years ago, 3 years ago,
mm-hmm,
I really did not expect it to have taken off in the way it did. And I certainly didn't expect it to, mindfulness to itself as a concept, to be a talking point across society. I just did not expect that. I hoped it would happen, and I felt in my bones that it could possibly happen. But I've always been a bit of an idealist, you know. I was trying to temper my idealism, but it does seem to be happening, and it's happening because society is at a real crisis point, and mindfulness is one of the solutions to our problems.
Yeah, and one thing that I really liked as well when reading a bit about your about the work that you've done, it's the, I don't know if it's in direct relation to the, you know, the people that I find that are mindful tend to be very nice as well. I've never met someone that's been mindful and been a bit of an ass. So the bit that I copied down here, and I'll read it out, it says, in 2009 and 11, you won the Humane Society of the United States Bridget Bardot International Print Journalism Award.
Oh, yeah.
For your investigations into animal welfare abuses around the world.
Yeah.
But yeah, as I liked it, it said, it was presented in front of an invited Hollywood audience that included Ellen DeGeneres. And again, you know, she very much into mindfulness now.
Oh, yes.
In 2011, he won the Royal Society for the Prevention of Cruelty to Animals, the RSPCA Special Investigation Award. So, you know, so it's really nice to hear that, you know, your involvement in these kind of charities in these fields.
Yeah, I mean, it's, you know, I went into journalism because I just had really strong beliefs about, you know, how the world needed to change. And you know, I became I went in the direction of more investigative journalism because, you know, I was just desperate to let the world know about certainly what was happening to animals on factory farms, hunting, you know, in laboratories around the world. And I just felt that the, you know, my role, as it were, was to try and highlight these. And, you know, it was great to be recognized by the Humane Society of the United States and the RSPCA. Again, you know, I didn't really expect that, but, you know, it's nice to have these things noticed, you know. When I write those stories, I kind of often feel slightly glum, thinking, yeah, I'm doing my best here. I've just seen some horrible things, and let's hope somebody else notices as well.
You've actually been to a lot of these places, like, you know, things that, I guess, people haven't seen, things like Earthlings, Food Inc. and stuff like that, where you see, have you actually been to the farms yourself?
Oh yeah. No, I my specialism is actually infiltrating farms or slaughterhouses or that kind of thing.
We both have a big grin on our face now.
It's because I just, you know, I mean, how else can you do it? You know, if you're going to rely on footage obtained by pressure groups, I mean, that has its place, but it's far better if the journalist themselves goes out and experiences it for themselves.
So just another quote, Danny. Danny Penman is a feature writer for the Daily Mail, having formerly worked for the BBC, New Scientist and the Independent newspaper, holds a PhD in biochemistry and specialises in reporting on science, health and the environment and animal welfare. commentator on these issues for the BBC, for BBC 4 Radio 4 and 5, and has made a number of documentaries for BBC 1 and Channel 4 News.
Yeah. Yeah. Yes, I mean, luckily I've always been very lucky at how I've managed to get stuff into quite radical issues, really, into the kind of mainstream media. And I think it just goes to show, if you hold beliefs passionately, somebody will listen. You know, if you just present people with the facts, as it were, and but still maintain your passion, I just think it's people will listen. And
it's very more convincing as well, you know, when you're telling it with passion. And
exactly. And I certainly the animal welfare stuff I see as part of a bigger project, you know. Mindfulness fits into that project. I don't know how you define that project, but I just think that it's really important that people know how we relate to the natural world and to animals and to each other.
You know, we've always tried to be philosophical on the podcast, and, you know, the word philosophy itself, you know, the love of truth.
Yes.
And, you know, when you're studying your own mind and, you know, realizing, you know, mindfulness is very much, you know, it may not be the complete truth, but it's certainly, you know, it's taking the limited information that we know about our mind and brain and the way it works, now using it in a way where it's like, oh, now we're taking it to the next level two of the way that we control our thoughts that, you know, so many people do not know about.
Yeah, yeah. Well, exactly. It lets you distinguish between the kind of the mind's running commentary on the world and reality, because there is a fundamental difference that between thinking about something and experiencing it. And we tend to see them in the same way. We tend to, you know, if we go out for the evening or have dinner, for example, we tend to think all the way through that dinner about how we're enjoying it, for example. And actually, it's far better to experience it there and then. And we will enjoy it far more if we actually experience that food rather than thinking about enjoying the food. If it sounds like a distinction without a difference, but there is actually a fundamental difference. And it's only by practicing mindfulness meditation that you come to see that distinction. And that's why it improves people's lives so much, is that there's no longer a filter between them and the world. They can experience it directly. Mm-hmm. And you know, people in the past have tried to do that through many different means, but mindfulness is the most effective way.
Mm. Yeah, listening to your audiobook, I actually heard of it yesterday on YouTube, and I was laying there doing some of the exercises as well. It was really good. I just remember. But what I was thinking more, because you mentioned it's the external, but for me, I guess you're, in the book, you more focus more on the internal aspect of the experience and the feeling. So it's more how you're responding to the external circumstances, yeah, and feeling internally. And,
yeah.
And so I guess, as you say, it's kind of catching yourself and noticing when you're feeling anxious, for instance, or,
yeah,
you know, a bit stressed, or why am I thinking about, you know, doing this, washing the laundry, and you know, I mean, I'm not there at the moment, so
yes, exactly. But we all do it, you know. It is actually, we have to keep catching ourselves constantly to not live inside our heads. And you know, the world doesn't exist inside our head, it exists out there, and you know, we forget that at our peril.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So the place that I find myself at now is similar to you. You did an interview with Eileen Murphy in 2000, and you mentioned that in 2012, and I quote, "I decided to stop playing around on the fringes of mindfulness, stop quoting from it and stop referring to it loosely, and start, you know, and actually study it properly." So I'm very much at that place now, because I've been doing it for a long time. I've been, you know, saying how great it is without actually doing it seriously myself, you know. So, you know, every time I get angry or someone cuts me off in traffic now, I can step back and I can be relaxed. And I've got that aspect of mindfulness. Even when I play badminton now, yeah. Once I get on the court, I go, wow, you know, just being, if I say to myself, be mindful, placebo or not, everything seems to just be a little bit more clearer. But it's not that daily practice, which is actually the key to mindfulness. And I realize that now, but I haven't actually seen the benefits of that part yet. So, you know, I'm not going to stop, like you said, playing around on the fringes and like just dive in head first.
Yeah. Well, there is something about the daily practice of the meditation that makes a big, big difference in the long run. You know, you don't have to do it a lot. 10 minutes a day, 20 minutes a day is fine. But setting aside that time is really important, because it takes a long time to rewire your brain. And the sooner you get started, the better.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely an ongoing process. I mean, constantly discovering things, you know, constantly discovering things about your mind.
Yeah,
as you were saying earlier, you know, so it's just, I guess, ironing out the creases, which obviously, as our brain has evolved, it seems like we're always going to be stuck with thought anyway. So I guess it's more of a, it's like having your computer on all the time.
Yes.
If you have it on all the time, it's going to need to restart at some point. It's just like doing restart yourself every now and again, or just switching it off, switching off mind from the constant bombardment of thoughts. And I guess even adverts everywhere. I mean, every time you're watching TV, there's always adverts, and then you change the channel, there's adverts on every channel. And then you go onto the internet, and then there's adverts on the internet as well. So, you know, you're constantly being bombarded with, as you said, the images and the, you know, this is how you should be living, this would be more fun.
Yeah.
So I guess, people are always striving to reach something and forgetting what they've got around them.
Well, absolutely. And, you know, it's very difficult to... I mean, you can't opt out of the world at all.
Yeah.
What you can do is you can change your relationship to it. Mm-hmm. And that's just as effective in the long run. And, you know, mindfulness isn't so much about clearing the mind of thoughts, because you can't do that. You know, the mind thinks, it's what it does, you know, and
survival mechanism, isn't it?
Yes. So it's really understanding how the brain works, and this is the key of mindfulness, is learning how your brain works and when it's sending you a stream of propaganda and when it's experiencing the world directly. And learning to distinguish between the two is quite important. And also thinking is tremendously important. You know, rational critical thinking is the foundation stone of kind of our industrial society. And if we didn't have that, we'd still be living in caves, to be honest. And I don't know about you, but I'd quite like a reasonably decent material standard of living compared to living in a cave. So, you know, what it is, what we've done in the Western world over the past few centuries, really, is we've prioritized one way of approaching the world. And it's tremendously effective at certain things, but it's detrimental in others. So the key for me is balancing the way we relate to the world. And that's what mindfulness does for me anyway. So, you know, what it allows me to do personally is to have all the benefits of, you know, living in the modern world and fewer of the downsides. And I think other people are finding the same thing.
Well, you're still going to have the downsides, but they're not as stressful as they would have been without these tools, for instance, or without, especially this tool, mindfulness.
Yes, exactly. But, you know, if everybody, or even most people, become happier and less stressed and anxious, well, the world will become a better place.
Yeah.
You know, it's only, you know, the problems in society result really from people's dissatisfaction. You know, anger, anxiety, stress, depression, you know, they all feed off each other. And if you can diminish them, then you end up in a virtuous cycle upwards rather than a vicious spiral downwards.
It's like Dharma versus Karma, isn't it?
Well, yes.
Because Karma is more the... I guess the way that I look at Karma is it's more like what you say, like most people are living... Like, you know, I think it was I read somewhere it was 80% or 90% of the day on autopilot.
Yeah.
So, you know, you wake up, brush your teeth, make your breakfast, go to work, switch on the computer, and, you know, you're kind of just doing things, but you're not really experiencing the moments.
Well, one of the challenges I find with explaining mindfulness to someone is that they kind of need to practice it.
Yes.
So the challenge is, well, what do you say to them? Like, you know, what sales pitch do you give them that will let them go away and then they'll go and practice it? Because once they start practicing it, that's when you have the best chance of, you know, getting that conversion success rate. So we're actually, we're trying to write the, I guess, the little, the layout for a 10 to 15 minute video that we're going to make.
Yeah.
And, you know, as we've spoken to different people on the podcast, they, you know, they've given us some great ideas on how to kind of present this.
Yeah.
One great one was, it was from Sam and Micah, who worked with at-risk youth in California.
Oh, yeah.
In the prisons systems there. And they said that the way that they said, you know, imagine, you know, I'm holding a bone and there's a dog in front of me and I wave it left and right. And then, you know, I throw it. You know, what is the dog going to do? And then everyone answers, the dog's going to run after the bone. But they said, well, now imagine that there's a lion and I'm doing the same thing. I'm waving it left and right. And then I throw it. And then what's the lion going to do? People answer, the lion's just going to eat the man. You know, he's not going to go after the bone.
Yes.
And it's the almost thing, you know, realize that you have the choice, you know, and it's being able to, you know, be the lion. So when they said that, they said that terminology to them, you know, the kids in the prison system, it seemed to work really well. You know, be the lion, and it was a good way to remember it.
Yes, absolutely, absolutely. How would I pitch mindfulness?
Well, another one that was used is, you know, imagine that you're an observer and then at a zoo, and there's a gorilla walking around, and your job is just to simply make notes on what he's doing.
Yeah.
So, you know, he's sitting down, you know, he's eating a banana, he's going potty, he's swinging in the trees, without judgment, and you're just making these notes. And it said, and then there was an exercise for 1 minute, just do that to yourself. You know, Guillaume, I'm sitting down, you know, doing podcasts, I'm looking at the screen, and I look out the window. And then when you do that, and actually just doing that simple exercise within 60 seconds on this video, I had my first kind of, you know, light bulb moment. And I said, wow, the tip of the iceberg. I kind of like tuned in just for a little bit. And I was like, okay. And then, you know, that was the hook that got me to, you know, understand mindfulness. Because at the Action for Happiness, I never understood it. Then I thought, yeah, this is cool. I get mindfulness. When in fact, I had no idea.
Yeah.
So these little things we're going to throw in together. And in a short 10-minute video, hope to have something that's maybe appeal to all generations. And, you know, so...
And you're asking me for ideas. Well, God.
Maybe not ideas, but I mean, you know, has there been any great advice that you've received in this, this particular journey?
Yeah. Right. What's resonated with you? What's made you think, wow, you know, that's something I need to, you know, or it's just been just a wow moment or an aha moment?
Well, it's really just the realization that life needn't be a struggle, you know. You needn't wrestle with your thoughts. You needn't be anxious or stressed or unhappy. Yeah, there is actually another way of dealing with life. And, you know, it's very difficult to... to really understand mindfulness, you're right, you just have to go away and do it. Mm-hmm. The benefits are beyond doubt. You know, ask anybody who's meditated for any length of time. Yeah. Ask any scientist who's studied it.
And for our listeners, it is an actual physical change in the brain.
Oh, yes, absolutely.
Yeah, as I said earlier, definitely check out the clip on BBC Breakfast on YouTube.
Yeah.
Type in mindfulness BBC, but it's a video that I will have, you know, up with this podcast page.
Yeah. I mean, to turn it around 180 degrees. The one thing I was concerned about before I took up mindfulness was, is this going to dumb down my brain? You know, is this going to switch off my brain and I'm going to start wandering around in orange robes? And I was also worried, you know, is it possible to do too much meditation? Mm-hmm. And Actually, the more I've learned about it, I realize that's completely and utterly wrong. For a start, you can't meditate too much because you just don't have the time. Simple as that. And it's extremely effective at clarifying the mind. It boosts creativity, clarity of thought. It helps you make more efficient decisions. And if you're spending less time each day struggling with your own thoughts, you can free up far more time with which to enjoy life. And that, to me, is what's important about mindfulness, is actually it releases this kind of inner happiness that allows you to just get on with life as it should be lived.
Mm. And what's your view on stuff like the power of now and living in the moment? Because that's one thing that the more I get into mindfulness, the more I keep seeing that reoccurring theme, that it's all about the present and now, and you know, it's nothing but this instant right now. It's a concept that's a bit hard to understand.
Yeah. I mean, I see it both ways because, you know, it is, of course, important to enjoy every moment that you're alive. But equally, you can't live your life without planning for the future and thinking about the past, you know. So in a sense, it's almost like an extremist position to say you've got to live in the moment. Mm. And of course, that's true. But in reality, you also have to live in the real world, which is defined by time.
Yeah, what am I going to have for dinner tonight?
Exactly, exactly.
I'll pop by Tesco's to make sure that I got enough for tonight, you know.
Yeah.
So.
You can even have some bad news or something like a family death. Something.
Absolutely.
All
of our emotions rise and fall constantly, you know. You can't banish unhappiness from your life. You know, apart from the fact that it's a necessary emotion, it's just part of life. You know, sadness is part of life. Joy is part of life. All of our emotions are there for a reason, and we might as well accept that. And when we accept it, we will actually have a far more interesting and fulfilling life as well.
For me, I find it makes the good times even better. And even the bad times, it makes you kind of, like, recently one of my good friends passed away.
Yeah.
I just remember feeling different waves of emotion, you know, so I was able to just sit back and observe them, you know, and sometimes you go through pain, anger, and then there'll just be moments of nothingness as well. You know, we literally and sometimes I was sitting there asking, this is actually quite nice, this nothingness.
Yeah. Well, you know, I mean, of course you're going to be sad when one of your friends dies. I mean, why would you not be? It would be almost disrespectful if you weren't unhappy. So just accepting those thoughts, those emotions, I just think is tremendously important.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
The community that mindfulness brings is something that I've been enjoying recently.
Yeah.
Mm. I've met so many great people through this little mindfulness journey.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Everyone that I've met they're always very nice. They're an older crowd. The crowds, you know, I went to my first meditation class, like I said, on the weekend in Covent Garden, and you know, me and Anne were by far the youngest people there. So there's a niche. There's a niche market, and it's, you know,
yeah. You know, I'm surprised by that because lots of people of all ages are getting into it. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. Maybe it's self-selecting. Maybe people under 25 or 30 just don't go to public mindfulness meetings. I mean, luckily it's something you can do in the privacy of your own bedroom.
Yeah, well, co-host Anne, he's a maths teacher.
Yeah.
He actually started a new job at a new college this week, so he couldn't be here.
Yeah.
But, you know, he makes his class do, you know, 5 minutes of meditation before each math class.
Yeah, that's good. Just clarifying the mind in that way is brilliant, I would have thought, for mathematics. Because let's face it, you do need a very clear, rational mind to do some maths, don't you?
Yeah, maybe a maths teacher might be in a better position to do it than, you know, their parents at home. They might think, you know, if their parents were to do that, they'll think, you know, my mum's gone crazy or something, you know.
Yeah, yeah.
Unless the parents are doing it themselves, and it just becomes, because normally that's like what they say, monkey see, monkey do. So you kind of just You know, I guess if people just start, you know, making it their own habit, and then other people just want to be saying, oh, what are they doing differently? Why are they so relaxed all the time?
That
even under stress, they seem a bit more, you know, not as stressed out as I would be, for instance, you know?
I mean, each to their own, really. I mean, it's usually possible to find somewhere to kind of meditate each day. I often go to a park near where I live. There's a wonderful bench, and I just sit on that bench, close my eyes for 10 minutes, and just listen to the sounds, you know, the birds in the trees, the trains hammering past, you know, aircraft in the sky. It's all part of the soundscape, as it were. And,
definitely. You know, the sounds of nature, I think Alan Watts referred to them as, you know, because I listened to some of his stuff as well when he was talking about meditation.
Yes.
And, you know, so that was really interesting as well. So it kind of does make you aware of the different, I guess, the sounds of music of nature, you know, which is just the wind and the trees and the birds singing.
Yeah. Yeah. Which doesn't have to be nature, even.
It's true. Even urban scape as well.
I mean, the world's a noisy place. You might as well make the most of it.
Have you ever tried an isolation tank, Daniel?
Yes, I did, actually. I did a story on this a couple of years ago, and it was really horrible.
Wow.
Really did not like it at all. It was an organization.
Or was it before you were into mindfulness then and meditation?
No, it wasn't. I thought I'd find it quite easy and therapeutic, but actually what it was to induce what they call lucid dreaming, where you're asleep, but you're controlling your own dreams, so you become like a Hollywood director, directing your own thoughts, dreams. And I was asked to do this story, and I really did not like it. Because I spent the whole night in this isolation tank, and
the whole night.
Yes.
Wow. I know people that do an hour. I did an hour session.
It worked. It was quite interesting, in that we went to sleep, and then just as our dreams were beginning, they would wake us up, and we went into this flotation tank, and I think it was every 90 minutes or so they'd come and wake us up, to make sure that we were kind of lucidly dreaming. Mm-hmm. But I really didn't find it pleasant at all.
Mm. But the ability to remove all senses, because the water is your skin temperature, so you don't know where the water ends and your skin begins, and no pressure on the bones, because you're floating in a bathtub of salt.
Yeah.
No, so I thought that for a practiced meditator, it would have been, you know, you go in there, so it's like a catalyst, and bam, you go straight into your meditative state, and then you get to enjoy the ride there on after.
Well, the thing is, this was to do with lucid dreaming. So the idea was to go to sleep and take control of your dreams. And I just found that I was having, I wouldn't describe them as nightmares, but it was quite unsettling dreams, and it just wasn't very pleasant, to be honest.
Well, they said that during sleep, there is, you know, we release DMT, the brain.
Oh, right.
Dimethyltryptamine, and that is, you know, the hallucinations that we see in the psychedelic aspects. You know, we produce that naturally, and it's only been proven in the past, like, 20, 30 years.
Okay.
Pineal gland is responsible for that. And, you know, I think is it in REM sleep? You know, when it's the most deep towards the end of your sleep, that's when the most is produced. And, you know, we dump it just before we die as well. There's a massive dump of DMT from the brain. We don't know why.
It's like a life flashback, isn't it?
Oh, right. It's interesting. Everybody else seemed to have a great time, but me, maybe I was just having an off day.
I thought it would have been quite cool, because I'd probably go and take flight like Superman or something. Control of the dream, I'd be like, yeah, I can fly. Yeah.
Well, I have spoken to people, and that was their experience, you know.
Yeah.
I just had rather muggy, unhappy dreams, really. It was I was fully expecting to have a fine time, but I didn't.
Wow, okay, interesting. Yeah, because I haven't actually tried it yet, but Dee and Jaitlin a little while ago, and they really enjoyed their experience. So so it's interesting to hear another point of view, but yeah. I'm not too sure if I'll be trying the
all-night one
at the moment.
Maybe start
for an hour first.
don't let me put you off. I mean, everybody else seemed to have a great time. It was just me that was being the stick in the mud.
everyone has a different experience. I mean, that's what we're here for, aren't we? We're all here to experience different things, or we all share our experiences, and not everyone, you know, that's the beauty of life. I mean, even food, you know, we all eat the same food, but we all taste it differently, you know, depending on our taste buds.
And what
we become accustomed to, etc.
And I'd be keen, Danny, if you were just to do like an hour session, you know, and just, you know, just meditation, you know, I would be keen to see if that, without any ulterior motive, but to go and meditate and, like, as you would normally, but in, you know, with no other, you know, distractions, I'd be interested.
Yeah. I mean, I have done lots of meditation retreats and never had any negative experiences. Maybe I was just having a bad day. I don't know.
So you've got a new book coming out soon, right?
Yes. Mm. Well, I've just got another one that was published recently called Mindfulness for Health. And that's used for pain relief and helping people cope with chronic ill health. It seems to be helping quite a few people, which is very heartening. And that's called Mindfulness for Health, a practical guide to relieving pain, reducing stress, and restoring well-being.
Yeah.
I'm just writing another one that's really, hopefully, will help people kind of optimize their health and happiness and well-being. You know, optimize the way they live their life. Again, it's using mindfulness techniques.
Yeah, because there's something to be said about, you know, not for the people that are depressed, but, you know, those that live in a good life and enjoying life. But, you know, for them just to pick up this, and it's like this extra skill now. And so it's, you know, because I like seeing mindfulness as not just a cure for depression, but, you know, it's that key skill that everyone should be proficient in.
Yeah. Well, absolutely. You know, it's. I think it's really important to see the positive aspect of it, rather than, you know, it's good for relieving depression and stress and what have you. It's about helps you live your life to the full.
Exactly. Yeah.
You know.
But after a while, it becomes habit anyway. It's one of those things. I mean, you start becoming a bit more mindful in general. I mean, it's like one of those things. Once you learn it, you can't really unlearn it. It's there, isn't it? So keep on. I guess you know, because obviously everyone has their off days. And okay, so that wasn't a good reaction. So maybe I can do better the next time. So you find yourself constantly improving.
Yeah. Well, exactly. And you know, that's the essence of mindfulness, is just releasing you from the. Releasing you from your thoughts, as it were, and allowing you to just live life to the full. And you know, that's what it gives me anyway.
Really good.
All right, so Danny, people can follow you on Twitter, right?
They can, Dr. Danny Penman, and there's obviously my website too, which is www.franticworld.com.
FranticWorld.com, and I'll have this up. All these links, and that BBC video.
Oh yes, yeah.
Links to your book. You know, I'll put it all up on the podcast page, and hopefully I'll have it out by the end of the week.
Oh, brilliant! Yeah, send me a link as well, so I can tweet it.
Yeah, I'll send you everything first, so you can have a look first before we do anything with it, and then, you know, we can we'll follow up then.
Yeah, that sounds good. And if there's ever anything else you need. Or you want to chat again, just let me know.
No, just, you know, your contribution to mindfulness has been incredible, you know, and it's
really,
you know, it's
really enjoying this time you've spent with us as well, so thank you very much.
Hopefully you and the listeners will get something out of it.
Yeah,
Definitely.
If not, you'll have to phone me up again and we can chat some more about something else.
Well, two of us here have definitely got something out of it. So, I mean, that's already made a difference, you know. So,
yeah.
I'm sure other people that we know will get something out of it as well. So
That's good. And people can download quite a few of the meditations from the book as well from the website. If they go to the resources section of the website, there's lots of meditations there, including my favourite, which is the chocolate meditation.
Okay.
Yeah, you can't go wrong if you're meditating on a piece of chocolate, I tell you. And you can adapt it to anything. You can have beer, tea, coffee, whatever. The same principles apply.
Nice. Learn a little treat.
Exactly.
All right, well, on that note, Danny, thank you very much, and we'll be in touch soon.
Brilliant. Okay, great to talk, and give us a call some other time.
All right, take care, Danny.
Thank you. Bye-bye.
Some of the smartest dummies can't read the language of Egyptian mummies on a flag or a moon, and can't find food for the starving tummies. Pay no mind to the youths, cause it's not like the future depends on it. We'll save the animals in the zoo, cause the chimpanzee them a make big money. This is how the media pillages, on TV the picture is savages and villages, and the scientists still can't explain the pyramids. Evangelists making a living on the videos of ribs of the little kids, stereotyping the image of the images, and this is what the image is. You buy a khaki pants and all of a sudden you are say a Indiana Jones, and I thief all the gold and thief all the scrolls and even the bird bones. Some of the worst paparazzi I've ever seen and I ever known, put the words on this place that the world can see, and that's all that will ever show. So the ones in the west will never move east and feel like it'll be at home. Get tricked by the beast, but the way them a go flee when the monster is fully grown. Salamonic lineage where them still can't defeat and them could have never clone. A spiritual DNA that prints in my soul and I will forever own, Lord. We born not knowing, are we born knowing all? We growing wiser, are we just growing tall? Can you read thoughts? Can you read palms? Can you predict the future? Can you see storms coming? The earth was flat, if you went too far you would fall off. Now the earth is round, if the shape changed again everybody would have start love. The average man can't prove of most of the things that he chooses to speak of, and still run research and find out the root of the truth that you seek of. Scholars teach in universities and claim that they're smart and cunning. Tell them find a cure when we sneeze, and that's when their nose start running. And a rich get stitched up when we get cut. Wanna heal them broken bones in the bush with a wet mud. Can you read signs? Can you read stars? Can you make peace? Can you fight war? Can you milk cows even though you drive cars? Can you survive against all odds now? Bible, who wrote the Quran? And was it a lightning storm that gave birth to the earth and then dinosaurs were born? Who made up words? Who made up numbers? And what kind of spell is mankind under? Everything on the planet we preserve and can it. Microwave it and try it, no matter what, we'll survive it. What's you? What's man? What's human? Anything along the land we consuming, eating, deleting, ruin. Trying to get paper, what? Gotta have land, gotta have acres, so I can sit back like Jack Nicholson, watch play the game like the Lakers. In a world full of 52 fakers, gypsy seances, mystical prayers. You superstitious, throw salt over your shoulders, make a wish for the day, cuz like somebody got a doll of me, sticking needles in my artery, but I can't feel it. Sometimes it's like part of me, but I got a real big spirit, a fearless. Don't you try to grab hold of my soul. It's like a military soldier since 7 years old. I held real dead bodies in my arms, felt their body turn cold. Oh, why are we born in the first place if this is how we gotta go? Damn. Savali. Patience. Yeah.